Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Aparuta te sangham tassa dwara yesu tuvanto pamanchantu sadhan. What is it that we know? What is it that we think we know? Are we able to tell the difference? Is there such a thing as pure knowing or pure awareness? If there is such a thing as pure awareness, how does it differ from impure awareness? Is pure awareness something that we need to get to, that we haven't experienced? Or is pure awareness just another aspect or another dimension of what we're all experiencing right now? What is this experience that's happening? What is this consciousness that's unfolding right here? Can we describe it to ourselves? Can we know it? Can we actually know our own knowing? Can we embody ourselves in that knowing? Or are we forever distanced and separated? Does that knowing ever stop? What about when we're asleep, or if we're unconscious, or if we've fainted? Does the knowing stop then? Is there a gap? And what about when we're awake? Does the consciousness drop out in between different events? Like, is there seeing and then a dropping out and then a hearing or something like that? If there was that drop out, how would you know? If there's no knowing in there, if there's nothing there, no awareness in that period when it drops out, then how would you know that? When you look into your mind, can you see change? Can you actually see change? It certainly looks like you can. It certainly seems as if you can just watch things changing. But when you examine it a little more closely and reflect on it, you begin to wonder, is that really change that I'm seeing? I wonder whether we can think of experience as being like a movie where you have successive frames, one frame and then the other frame. And in one frame you see just a moment of stillness. The next frame you also see another moment of stillness. And no matter how many frames you see, thousands and thousands and thousands of them, all you ever see is stillness. But what you're watching is movement. So when we begin to reflect like this, we begin to wonder, is that really, am I seeing change? I thought I could close my eyes and look into my mind and see things changing. I can see my feelings change, my thoughts change, consciousness change. That's certainly what it seems like. But is that really how it is? When I look into at a movie, it also seems to me that the pictures are changing. It seems to me that the people are moving around on the screen. It seems to me that it's in constant motion, constant change. And yet I know that if I were to look behind the scenes and analyze what's going on, actually what I would see is just a series of static images. And so I begin to wonder, where does the change actually happen? If it's not actually in the screen. And the same applies in the mind. I begin to wonder that if all I can see is the present moment, and the present moment can't be moving or changing, can it? Because that would take one moment and then another moment and like a stream of moments and changing. But if there's only one moment that we actually know, then how can that be changing? That one moment must be totally serene and totally still. Frozen. And yet, our world of experience is nothing but change. So how can this be? How can it be that we actually see nothing but stasis? And yet, in our mind, we're seeing constant change. When we read our first book on Introduction to Theravada Buddhism, that book doubtless would have explained to us that One of the most widely accepted facts of the Dhamma, which is that the Buddha said that all reality has three characteristics, like three stamps. The three stamps, of course, being anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanent suffering and not self. And so in a sense we're programmed, it's suggested to us that we should look and see these things. We should look into the world and see impermanence. We're told that the Buddha's enlightened, he's the most wise human who's ever existed. He penetrated to the bottom of reality and exposed the very workings of existence, and this is what he found. And so when we come to sit meditation, we look in our meditation, we say, aha, there it is, it's impermanent, just like the Buddha said. In the same way that a Christian meditator would be told that Jesus is the way, the truth and the light, and that if they meditate on the name of Jesus, then he will appear to them. And that if they go to the radiant bliss and light that is Jesus, then they will be saved, be lifted up from this mundane existence and taken into heaven. And so they come, they sit meditation, recollect the name of Jesus and his qualities, and they see him, they see an image of Jesus, they see the light coming out of him, and they go into that light and become one with it, and they're lifted up to heaven and are saved from the suffering of mundane existence. So what's the difference? Is there any difference? Buddhists are programmed to see impermanence in their meditation, and so they see impermanence. Christians are programmed to see Jesus in their meditation, so they see Jesus. Is there really any difference? Is impermanence something which actually exists out there? Is it really stamped? On being. Or is it, as some would say, that when we ask to contemplate on impermanence, we're really not looking at what is or how existence is, but we're using a strategy of perception. So we're using a way of paying attention that's useful for liberation, and the kind of the truth value of that is irrelevant, whether it's true or not. This is another way of looking at it. So I begin to wonder whether, when we're looking at impermanence, what actually are we seeing? Are we seeing change? Or is change something that we impose on our experience? Is change something which is cooked up in the mind? Is impermanence not a characteristic of reality, but rather a characteristic of how our mind works? I think this gives rather a different spin on things. We're rather more involved. We become less like a chemist who puts his chemicals in his test tubes and mixes them up and heats them over a Bunsen burner and sees what happens. And assumes, without reflecting on it, that whether he does it or whether any other scientist does the same experiment, that they'll get exactly the same results. So we become a little less like that, and a little more like perhaps a psychiatrist who recognizes that it's their very presence, their personal presence, which enables the truth to happen in a sense of relationship, that it arises in a way that otherwise may not. And again, if we were to follow this analogy through about these two different kinds of ways of exploring the truth, if we were to look at a chemist, and if we want to understand the material that we're using, we would act upon that. We would subject it to various kinds of analysis in order to break it down and into its parts and understand what each atom is, what each element is that makes it up, what's the proportion of the elements, under what conditions can the elements combine to form molecules, and under what conditions will those, can I turn them solid or liquid or make them form in various ways? So our approach to meditation becomes a little bit less like that and a little bit more like a approach of a psychiatrist who sort of sits there next to the couch and just allows the patient to speak with a minimum of interference and a minimum of direction. And the main job of the therapist in that context is to provide empathy. Is to bring a sense of care into the moment so that whatever is expressed is understood and accepted. And the therapist does not delude themselves that they are somehow independent of this process. On the contrary, it's quite essential to what they're doing that they understand that their presence is the very factor that makes the process work. And that with time and with patience and with compassion, with the building up of trust, then the patient will feel free to express themselves in ways that are deeper, more real, and more healing. So the same principles apply in our meditation. We're not chemists or biologists with like a specimen on the bench. We have to cut up into all its bits and then see what each bit is. The mind isn't a specimen. It's not a kind of passive lump of stuff. The mind lives. The mind breathes. The mind speaks. The mind wants to make itself known. Haven't you felt that? Haven't you felt this kind of urge that we have to express ourselves? This kind of push to speak. In Pali they call that vachi vinyati or kaya vinyati or vachi vinyati. It's like expression. So this kind of desire to make yourself known, desire for the internal states of one's own consciousness to represent themselves in speech, in action, in words. And we know it's quite hard to restrain this. We have to learn this as we grow older, that we can't always speak when we want to. We have to restrain our speech. We can't always do what we want to, we have to restrain our acts. We can't just let our mind do whatever it wants to do. And so the mind learns to hide. And this is something it needs to do. It needs to develop this restraint. But it also needs to be aware that it's doing this. It needs to be conscious that what is expressed is not necessarily the whole truth in every circumstance. The whole truth is sometimes very hurtful, sometimes very painful. And in fact, the whole truth is actually impossible. We can't express the whole truth all the time. No matter if we were talking non-stop all day, we can't express the whole truth about anything. So we have to filter, we have to express what's that part of the truth that needs to be expressed. And when we settle down in our meditation, we settle down on our cushion, and we need to develop that heart of trust with our own mind. Just as the therapist needs to develop this trust with their patient if healing is to happen. You have to have that sense of security, of ease, of contentment. And then the heart will be free to speak those things that it really needs to speak, but which it normally keeps hidden. And we begin to penetrate the agendas and the devices of the heart, the ways that it disguises, the ways that it hides itself away, that it protects itself. We learn about these worlds that are concocted within our heart. These worlds that we think we see out there. Please consider this very, very carefully. I'm suggesting to you that if you open your eyes for one fraction of a second, just enough to focus your eyes and watch and close again, what you see in that one tiny flash of visual consciousness, you see change. You see something moving. Maybe you see the candlelight moving. This is a very still room. The people here are sitting very still. But nevertheless, there's still movement happening. You maybe see the candle flame moving a tiny bit. And close your eyes again. Now in that change, even that tiny flicker, that tiny innocuous movement, which is only just perceptible to your eye consciousness, the movement is not happening in the eye, it's not happening in the sight. The movement is happening in the mind. The movement is something which you have cooked up in order to explain why you're getting different impulses and stimulations from your eyes. The eyes present you with what really is little better than chaos, present you with a vast quantity of information, and no way of decoding that and making sense of it. Your eyes merely dump all this information on your doorstep and say, deal with it, and then walk off. Meanwhile, your ears come and dump another load, your nose dumps another load, your tongue dumps another load, your body dumps an even bigger load, and then your mind dumps an even bigger load again. And by that time your eye is turned up again and is dumping another load. And so he's saying, deal with it. And this incredible flood of data that's coming in through the eyes and through all the senses. And even in such a tiny little snippet, your mind is working to put these things together. Your mind is saying, this is a candle flame. This is not a candle flame. this is light, this is dark. Your mind is saying this is movement. Even in such a tiny little thing, your mind is playing such a big role. What to speak of the big things in our life? What to think of a notion like person? What to speak of a notion like relationship? What to speak of a notion like understanding? If even the most basic and simple of sense experiences is in fact senseless and meaningless without the mind, then where are all these other things coming from? All of these other notions are built up upon so many layers of abstraction, so many layers of inference, that our minds are working overtime, smothered with the effort simply to deal with it and sort it out and remain sane. If your mind can't sort these things out, you go mad. And so there's this constant effort to sort them out and stay sane. This is why our brains are such complex instruments. And what we call knowledge, what we call wisdom, what we call understanding, very often is just floating around on the top of this vast mass of abstractions. How are we to get to the bottom of this? How are we to sort out all these details? Is the job of our meditation somehow to cut off this flow of information, not have it? Is the job to be able to see the data in its raw form, so you see like the source code of consciousness? Is this the point? You see a load of ones and zeros and that's understanding? Is that what we're supposed to do? How can we see the seer? How can we know the knower? If our knowing consists of these things, how can we have a knowing which is apart from them? If our consciousness is created by this process, how can we have a consciousness that is not involved in that process? How can we have a pure awareness, a pure knowing, that's not bound up with concepts, when concepts are what has built our mind in the first place? Concepts are what has rescued us from the chaos of bare experience. Wisdom is not about being buried in chaos. So this is probably enough for this evening. I'll leave you with this. And hopefully I've raised more questions than I've answered. So if anyone has any more questions or comments, then please feel free, and I'll probably answer with counter questions.